We are very pleased to be joined today by Jen Hocken, who is a former nurse, psychology professor, who taught at Portland State University from 1980 to 2011. Now, Jen works as a documentary filmmaker and a radio programmer on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio and has just put out a film called The Palestine Exception. Thank you for joining us, Jen Hocken.
Good to be here, Jenka.
And I want to just start with what is the Palestine exception? What does that refer to?
Well, the term itself, I think, initially was coined by Palestine Legal, a group that's been very active and remains active in providing legal advice and counsel to students, workers, faculty, and other and groups that have been targeted for their Justice for Palestine work. And the term refers to particularly groups that generally support liberal causes or social justice causes, gay rights, queer, gender justice, racial justice, but who have been historically pro-Israel and dominated of course, the Democratic Party, as we saw throughout the campaign of Biden and then Harris, really shut down what we show in the film to be the largest anti-war movement since the 1970s, continue to arm Israel, and to insist that this was the one genocide. The one they wouldn't use that term, but internationally, what Israel's doing is recognized as a genocide that has been met with and continues to be met with silence, even by liberals, in the US and in some other countries abroad, particularly in Europe, like Germany.
At a certain point, you talk about McCarthyism, and I just want to play the Republican Congress member from New York, Elise Stefanik, grilling the academics, the presidents of three major universities about people calling for a genocide of the Jews, and that apparently turned out to be a someone in Los Angeles mishearing a chant.
Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
It depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
The line of questions kept coming back to calls for Jewish genocide that actually nobody had made. I remember because it started at UCLA. The headline in the magazine report was "Students at UCLA Chant for Jewish Genocide." I remember thinking, "Wait, whoa! I was there. That's not what they were saying." I remember hearing it with my own ears. And I thought, "What have they doctored the audio? What's going on here?" And you hit play, and you hear, "We charge you with genocide." To give them the benefit of the doubt, somebody misheard that, and then in their own minds, it became, "We want Jewish genocide," which then gets fed via various lobbying organizations, because that's how our political system functions, to the various Republican, representatives on that committee who were castigating those university presidents.
And can you just tell a little bit of that background? Because that's one of the many things that have been kind of misconstrued or misrepresented about the protests and about the people protesting.
Well, one of the repressive tactics of authoritarian or right-wing movements, and certainly we see this with the Trump administration, but also with Israeli propaganda around their war on Gaza and the ongoing Nakba, is to kind of project outward what you're really about. So, to accuse activists of calling for genocide, it's a rhetorical ploy because it reverses what's happening. And so, we wanted to show a bit about how a discursive element or a rhetorical claim gets kind of picked up and distorted. And, that's a long-standing slogan in movements to say we charge you with genocide. Israel has been correctly charged at rallies with genocide, but then it gets picked up by, in this case, AIPAC and the Republican Congressional Committee that was driving a lot of this interrogation of presidents of universities saying students are calling for genocide, even though no one had heard that. And so we wanted to show some of how these claims, how they originate, how they get distorted, and how something you're doing gets projected onto the opposition.
Some of the people in your film talk about this, particularly the professor from the Yeshiva University, about the McCarthyism that she and others experienced in the 60s and 70s.
And it's going on today as well. This scenario of capitulation to outrageous student demands on the part of weak-willed liberal administrators. So it's just like Elise Stefanik asking about genocide and saying, you have to crack down.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. What is McCarthyism and how are we seeing it play out, both in the Biden administration and now in the Trump administration?
The term neo-McCarthyism or the new McCarthyism has been attached to the crackdown on justice for Palestine activism on campuses since the start of this project, late fall of 2023. And it's both a useful historical comparison. Some say it's the most useful one we have at hand in comparing what's happening now, what's been intensified under Trump with cracking down and threatening with deportation, arrests, kind of random picking up people in a way of silencing protests, opposition, creating an external enemy that then becomes not just the external enemy, but the idea of the enemy within. So with McCarthyism, there was a paranoia about communists who were the evil enemy after World War II. And of course, the social movements in the left more generally, the labor movement, the civil rights movement that emerged were silenced. And many people did lose their jobs. Many people were blacklisted, some permanently, some temporarily. We're most familiar with the McCarthyism as it affected Hollywood, which was emerging, as a cultural center. I think people are less aware of McCarthyism as it affected academia. So that's part, that's our central story, is about the university as a setting of knowledge production, of that the state and capitalism depends on the production of knowledge, research, and skills that are central to the functioning of the society, but it's also been a site of protest historically, resistance, critical thinking, and the repression of movements as well.
And now we've seen this massive crackdown on the student protests. There are now these attempts by the Trump administration to deport certain student leaders. And I wanted to hear your perspective on this as someone who's been covering this for the last year and a half, especially the case of Mahmoud Khalil from Columbia University, who I believe has a Palestinian passport. So, with Palestinians having no state living under this brutal military occupation with US support, where would a Palestinian American get deported to? Or will it be like Mo in the Netflix series where Mohammed Amer's character gets deported, but as a Palestinian has to stay in Texas with an ankle bracelet because the US won't send him back to Palestine?
The fantasy land of Trump, send him to Alcatraz. A lot of he's languishing now in Louisiana, and there are, there's a film called The Encampments that does feature him and feature the encampments primarily at Columbia. But there's a mix of people, the most vulnerable being immigrants, and particularly people who've been involved in the Justice for Palestine movement as activists that are being picked up. Some in a kind of limbo status in Louisiana, some have fled the country. But I think the aim here is to, terrorize people into silence. And the film kind of opens with, we'll see what happens, whether people can be bludgeoned into silence. But Sri Makdisi, who is the nephew of Edward Said, featured in the film, and Palestinian scholar at UCLA, said, but the genie can't be put back in the bottle.
Young people are able to see through the aspects of America's own repressed history, and they've also been able to translate their awareness of American history to these other contexts, including the one in Palestine. But the other thing that's really important is that increasingly in America, there's a growing sense that the struggle for Palestine is kind of connected to other struggles taking place in the U.S., above all, the indigenous land movement.
When South Africa was an apartheid regime, the United States supported them for a while. Israel supported them for a while. No. The United States will support fascism by any means necessary while claiming to be the protector of democracy. That's the largest open-air prison in the world, the longest-lasting one. Does that look like democracy?
Yeah!
And I think it's little wonder that a lot of this awareness comes through the experience on college campuses. That's where people learn about these histories. That's where people learn to connect the dots between these different histories. And college campuses are precisely the sites that right-wing American politicians and Zionists want to shut down, because people who learn aren't going to go on saying the same things that their parents or grandparents used to say. They're no longer going to toe the line. They're no longer going to just repeat the liberal mantras about Israel being a Jewish and democratic state. They're going to start asking, what does it mean to be a Jewish and democratic state, given that half the people that it rules over are not Jewish? How can it be a democratic state?
This movement has shaken things up for Israel that has had to shed its the righteous robe of protectiveness toward, that they exist as a protection for Jews worldwide, that they're a democracy, that they're having to always defend themselves from hostile players among the Palestinians. And I think a lot of that has been debunked, and we try to show in the film some of that history that's been repressed. And most Americans do know and continue to need to know about the legacy, the lessons of the Holocaust. And we felt that was important to acknowledge that there is anti-Semitism as a problem, that the lessons of the Holocaust are still very important to teach. But as Jewish Voice for Peace activists have insisted for decades, the lessons are not to commit genocide, that there is a moral call to say never again, never, and certainly never again in our name, as Israel continues to do in the name of Jews.
That piece about who holds title to calling something a genocide is something that is that you address in the film. And one of the people that you talk to, Sophie, one of the activists, describes her indoctrination as a youth. And just want to play hope of Sophie.
The kind of major touchstone for me is Jewish summer camp in middle school, because I really was interested in my Judaism growing up. Every summer at this camp on the Oregon coast called BB Camp. So we had these days where we went to different stations that depicted the life cycle of a Jewish person. And one of the stations was Go to Israel. And then there was this night called Escape to Israel Night, and it was a full-scale scenario in which the camp was transformed into a kind of Nazi gauntlet. The counselors pretended to be German guards, and all the campers were fleeing Jews trying to get to safety in Israel. Israel was at the lake. And you had to go through the lodge, show your papers, get screamed at, get onto a bus, hide under the seat when the guard comes on. If you got caught and arrested, you had to go do push-ups in a cabin while a counselor screamed at you. And the counselors, they were terrifying. This is where I really have started to understand the way in which re-traumatization around the Holocaust has been used really systematically within Jewish life from the left to the right to recruit us all into supporting unhinged militarism. And then once I learned that the United States provides 70% of Israel's military funding, the notion that that was actually a political proxy in the Middle East for United States interests was not hard for me to believe.
Well, I wanted Judith Butler, who's a pretty well-known intellectual globally, taught at UC Berkeley and German studies, German literature philosopher, who's written a lot about refugees and statelessness, and wanted her to address the difference between the claim that Netanyahu and Zionists often make, that the Holocaust was in its own categories evil, and that it overshadows anything else by comparison. And I've had friends of mine who are liberal Zionists who said, how dare you compare the millions of people murdered of my people with the tens of thousands that have been killed in the course of this war with Gaza? And often it's described as a Hamas-Israeli war. And so I wanted to have that drawn out in the film because I am in my own history as a scholar, there was a big debate, especially in the 70s and 80s, about Holocaust studies versus genocide studies. And some saying Holocaust studies has to be its own project and that other genocides pale in comparison to it. And that it was an evil on a scale, proportionately and methodically, instrumentally, that puts it in its own category of evil. And once you start using the word evil, you're kind of moving into a realm outside of science or the social sciences, where we try to understand the dynamics behind collective suffering or genocidal periods of history. So I wanted her to speak to that. What do we mean by genocide? Because the Genocide Convention was instituted the same time Israel was formed, and they agreed and signed on to that through the United Nations. So for Israel to say, we are victims of a genocide, the Holocaust, and it absolves us in perpetuity from any claim that we're committing genocide, because we're always having to defend ourselves. And hopefully the film does. There's more background, there always is, than you can include in the film. But it was a big debate in academia for decades over genocide studies, where a number of these genocides that have been documented could be compared and analyzed and learned from along with the Holocaust.
I think that people buy into that notion that the state of Israel is what saves the Jewish people from destruction. Beneath the bad reasoning of that argument is the ideological conviction that without the Jewish state, the Jewish people will be destroyed. But I would say that as Israel holds itself aloof from all international law and participates in a military action that increasing number of legal scholars call genocidal, it is jeopardizing the Jews. It is not saving the Jews. The only thing that is going to make the world safe for Jews is either equality for Palestinians, equal freedom, equal access, equal rights, equal political participation, and decolonization, quite frankly, because none of those liberal principles make any sense outside of decolonization.
A lot of administrators have submitted to these congressional hearings and now participating in the Biden administration's ongoing and intensified repression. And that's kind of the difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. We see more clearly what the Trump administration is doing. I mean, the cruelty and the viciousness, the failure to protect any group other than presumably Zionist students. But the universities are and have been for a long time, even public universities, are kind of run like businesses. I mean, Columbia, for example, is the largest property holder in Manhattan. They own vast amount of property, and the boards on universities, including Portland State University and public universities, are often people who are not just sympathetic to Israel, but have a broader economic set of interests in controlling or limiting critiques on campuses, critical movements that are critical of the power structure. So the boards of trustees on campuses have generally pressured universities and have for a long time, as Ellen Schrecker describes it in the history of crackdowns on campus movements. They have pressured administrators to crack down on activist movements on campus that kind of disturb the status quo. And so we're seeing that increasingly. I mean, it's also backfiring some under Trump. I mean, the universities depend very heavily on foreign students who pay much higher rates to come to the US to study at our universities that until recently have had a kind of global prestige, earned or not, deserved or not. But our university has, over de the decades, had less and less public support, so more and more tuition revenues depended on grants that are often tied to corporate interests, to big donors, and international students. So you're seeing a kind of crisis in how these administrators or the consequences of administrators trying to make a deal with Trump, because a lot of this has all kinds of consequences that follow across the board and go way beyond crackdown on student activists.
And what ultimately is so threatening to the establishment about students setting up camps on their campuses and, as the students in your film say, taking back their education, educating each other in the ways that the universities have neglected to teach them?
We tried to show in the film that the Justice for Palestine movement has a legacy in history. Part of it is it has a history connected with the left in this country. Movement, the discourse of these protests has looked at, as you mentioned earlier, the US's settler colonial project, as well as Israel as a colonial power. The movement is one of the last movements, anti-colonial movements, and its refusal to submit inspires people, their refusal to leave, even as they're destroyed at a level that is almost hard to get your mind around what's happening in Gaza and the ongoing intensity of it. And the people refuse to leave. And I think as an inspiration for protests against how the US is running things as an empire, the military industrial system we live under. Movements inspire more questions. And I think questioning the system of domination that both the Democrats have managed more effectively, both the Republican and Democratic parties have maintained and proudly maintained the US as a dominant military and economic power, with the systems of oppression worldwide that accompany that. So we wanted the film to kind of open up questions that go beyond the encampments or the specific actions to show there's a history of campuses being attacked around not just the intellectual life of the community, but as sites of activism.
And so your film is called The Palestine Exception. Again, I'm speaking with Jan Hocken. And where can people see your film? How can people arrange a screening or watch it on their own? Is that a possibility at this point, or are there just screenings?
Well, we finished the film in mid-November, and we've had over 100 screenings either held or scheduled through May. We've had a lot of campus screenings and community, some churches, synagogues, community spaces, libraries. And the idea is not just to watch a film and then while you're cooking dinner or in and out, but to have spaces where people are sharing an experience and having to discuss where we're at now, how do we think about the new horizon of this movement, and to create events and group experiences, just as movements themselves have to be collective group projects. So if you would subscribe to our website, PalestineExceptionFilm.com, or go onto that site, they can, there's a host a screening page, and you can there's a small screening fee. We try to make it available to all groups that have an interest in this. Some do it for fundraising for Palestine related work. And we really try to work with any group that wants to host a screening and to have a discussion afterwards.
Thanks. Yeah. And again, I'm speaking with Jan Hocken, filmmaker of The Palestine Exception. And speaking of heartening moments and things that bring us hope, I just want to end with a clip from your film.
Every single tribunal from Nuremberg to Rwanda, from Bosnia to Cambodia, every prosecution at the ICC was meant to atone for our moral failures, to protect us from ourselves. And today we fail to stop. Today we fail to stop the skies from crashing down in white phosphorus flames onto Palestinian dreams, memories, potential, onto Palestinian babies not old enough to beseech you to have mercy upon them. We are here now with them and for them to demand a ceasefire. We are here because Palestine reveals the naked hypocrisy of Western universalism. It reveals our enduring colonial reality, and it offers a glimpse into a future without colonialism.
William Blake said, "The history of all times and places is nothing else but improbabilities and impossibilities. What we should say was impossible if we did not see it always before our eyes." In other words, something you would have thought completely inconceivable can suddenly happen. We're seeing it all the time. If I had told you in the 1980s, within a few years, Nelson Mandela is not just going to be out of jail, he's going to be president of a free South Africa, you would have said, "I'm hallucinating." If I had told you in 1988, "I predict the Berlin Wall is going to fall, the Soviet Union will no longer exist as an enterprise within 5 years," you would have said, "What are you smoking?" Right? And yet, look what happened. All kinds of things have happened all through the history of the world that have never been predicted and never been anticipated, never been seen, and yet they happen. And that's what William Blake is talking about. But it's completely true.
It's always hard to give an audience a satisfying denouement when you're engaged in a very long, ongoing struggle. My recent films that had a kind of upbeat ending now are, we're in a darker phase with nuclear power and the climate justice movement, a fight against fossil fuels. So, but I also think, the ending of a film should hold up kind of a reasonable view of hope. I do think we're in kind of this melancholic period, which is different from clinical depression in that it can be a kind of generative state of awareness of loss and being hit by something, and that you have to kind of gather up what you have and not be deprived of what you know. And one thing McDeesey reminds us of is history can shift in unpredictable directions, and neither the future nor history itself are engraved in stone in some immutable way. Just as those of us who work to recover histories that have been forgotten or buried, we also have futures that are possible futures that get buried for us, where we get very limited and accept the inevitabilities of the masters and how they write history and how they forecast the future. So in that sense, I really believe in that open-endedness, but it depends on what we do about it. Like Karl Marx once said, we're humans are both made by history and make history. And that remains true. And that was the spirit we tried to bring to the conclusion of the film.
Well, I really appreciate that and appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today. Again, I've been speaking with Jan Hocken, one of the co-filmmakers of The Palestine Exception. And again, that website, PalestineExceptionFilm.com. Thank you, Jan, for being with us today on this Nakba special.
Thanks so much. And I really appreciate the remembering Nakba Day and how much of that history we need to continue to fight to remember, because it's an ongoing devastation that we need to continue to pay attention to.
Thanks very much. And this is Jenka Soderberg with KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon. الجبل يا مول للمقيدين النار بين ليل يامان يامان عين ليل الهنا يا روح ما بعتي منك ليلكم خلعة ولا لا 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 بدي زنار بين ليل يامان يامان عين ليل الهنا يا روح إلا غزال Well, today for this Nakba broadcast, we are joined by Professor Mazen Kumsia, who is a professor at Bethlehem University, author of a number of books, including Sharing the Land of Canaan, and is the head of the Palestinian Center for Biodiversity. Welcome, Professor Kumsia.
Thank you for having me, Jenka.
And I just want to start, because this is a Nakba Day broadcast, I know every Palestinian has a Nakba story. Maybe you could just share a little bit about your family and the Nakba of 1948 to get started.
Well, I'm one of 15 million Palestinians. About 8.5 or 9 million of us are refugees or displaced people. Some of my relatives are refugees. My own family is not a refugee family, so we were fortunate in that sense. But my mother lost her best friend in school in 1948 in the massacre of Deir Yassin. And my grandfather, her father, basically was orphaned in the First World War. So we had our own history of tragedy, but it's much less than what other people are suffering, certainly now in Gaza, with the ongoing genocide and people literally starving to death. Actually, number who were killed by bombs probably now rivals the number who are killed by starvation and diseases because of Israel's blockade on Gaza. So, and it's a horrific way to die by starvation and famine. So, we are in an era that an ongoing Nakba, if you want, or catastrophe for our people.
Yeah, it's been 19 months of just ongoing bombardment in Gaza. You've been sending regular weekly updates and to your list worldwide. And I know, I'm sure that during this broadcast, we're going to be hearing a lot about Gaza, but maybe you could just share a little bit about your experience over the last 19 months of this genocide.
Well, like all people of conscience, we've been watching the news, outreaching to friends and colleagues in Gaza. I have many of those friends and colleagues. Unfortunately, some of them are already killed. Those who are surviving are barely surviving. No water to mention, at least no clean water. And they have to travel long distances to get like a bucket of water or something for their daily use, and no food basically. And so they're, most of them have lost half their weight and are really in bad shape now, health-wise. I have a friend, for example, who's parents are both sick, one of them diabetic and lack of diabetic medicines. He's going blind basically. And also because the food, when available, is only just flour, and that's not good for diabetes. So it's not healthy for people. Another friend, his mother is in intensive care. Injured with some of his family members, including his children, as Israel bombarded their encampment. And his mother is probably not going to make it this week because lack of hospital care, medical care is gone. Basically, Israel destroyed most of the hospitals. So my own life, basically daily I have to struggle with these things and the news and WhatsApp messages and emails from people. Fortunately, we're still in contact by email and by WhatsApp and Signal and things like that. So the internet is still working in Gaza, miraculously. But the situation is horrific. And here in the West Bank, the situation is also bad. I was in the north today in Nablus area, and we passed by Al Farah refugee camp, where there was a lot of bulldozing of streets and some houses. Same as in Tul Karim and Jenin refugee camps. 40,000 people are basically homeless now from Jenin area, because Israel forced them out and destroyed some houses and things like that. And I could go on and on, but the bottom line is, it's one tragedy to the next every day, and one struggle to the next. And what hurts us most is the silence of the international community, other than some good people engaging in demonstrations and so forth. The Western world, especially the governments and the mainstream media, totally ignore an ongoing horrific genocide, an ongoing horrific ecocide, destruction of the environment, scholasticide, destruction of the universities and schools and educational system. So things are horrific.
And as somebody who's focused your life and is committed to climate justice, particularly in Palestine. I wonder if you could help make this connection. I don't think that it's unrelated, that Greta Thunberg, the great environmental activist from Sweden, is among those who were on a ship that was bound to Gaza with aid that was bombed by the Israeli military a couple of weeks ago off the coast of Italy. And as a person who's committed to climate justice, can you talk about how the struggle for justice in Palestine is connected to the global struggle for saving our planet from environmental destruction, human-caused environmental destruction?
Well, if you think about the enemy of humanity, who's the enemy of humanity? It's greed and rampant capitalism that's making us destroy biological diversity, destroy our planet via climate change and others, but also destroy human diversity to have monolithic societies. For example, a Jewish state here in Palestine is a system that replaced multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, and even multilingual society was and is being destroyed in order to create a monolithic Jewish state. Same thing in the US. We see people like Trump, who is paranoid about any non-white person. He and Musk is a neo-Nazi, basically, used even a Nazi salute. And they hate anybody who's different, blacks and Hispanics and everybody else. So Arabs, Muslims, whatever. So they want a white state, if you want, and they want a large white state, so they are looking to annex Canada and Greenland and Panama Canal. And they just signed a deal to steal the minerals of Ukraine. They think in colonialist mentality. And what we have to do is counteract this. How do we counteract this? We insist that indigenous people have rights and that they have a right to defend those rights. And we insist that indigenous people must unite across the globe to fight this greed, to fight for biodiversity and for human diversity, biological diversity and human diversity. Hence the connections between all of these things. If I take climate change, for example, well, the military is the biggest climate producer, climate change gases. Israel produced actually just from jet fuels flying over Gaza and bombing Gaza and Lebanon and Yemen, just from the jet fuel alone, they produced more greenhouse gases than most European countries produced in a year in the same period of time from all their sources, from kitchens and automobiles and trains and everything else, industries and so on. So you can see that climate change is also a war issue. Conflict and colonization is a pollution issue. Greed is a pollution issue. That's why we have more plastics now in the oceans of the world than we have fish in the oceans of the world. This is due to the greed and the insistence that we must have these styles of life that promote, consumerism beyond the capacity of our planet.
Yeah, and you talk about this connection in Palestine, in the West Bank, and in Gaza, and inside of Israel. There's an apartheid system. Apartheid beginning in South Africa as a system of racial segregation, and in Palestine, in the West Bank, a wall has been constructed beginning in 2003, and is now a virtually complete segregation. And I wonder if you could talk about the impact on the humans there, as well as the land and water, of this apartheid system that you're living in Palestine.
Well, many South African leaders who were instrumental in fighting apartheid, like Nelson Mandela and Stephen Biko and Desmond Tutu and others, have said that apartheid in Palestine is sometimes even worse than apartheid was in South Africa. We have segregated roads. We have two sets of laws, one for local Palestinians, indigenous people, one for the colonialist Jewish population, and so on and so forth. There is, of course, a destruction of our rights, right to land, right to education, right to freedom of movement. We cannot even move from one ghetto to the next ghetto, one Bantustan to the next Bantustan without Israeli permission. We have apartheid at different levels, religious apartheid, educational apartheid, spatial apartheid, visual apartheid even. In many ways, the apartheid that's practiced here is horrific, fits perfectly in the definition of the that's provided in the Global Convention Against the Crime of Apartheid and racial discrimination. And in fact, there were judgments of the International Court of Justice relating to the illegality of such a system. And we are awaiting the application of international law, if it ever existed. International law is being ignored. International Criminal Court issued even arrest warrants for Netanyahu and his Minister of Defense, as he's called, or Minister of War. And yet, nobody is arresting them. Netanyahu went to Hungary, went to the US, etc., and was welcomed, of course, among congressmen and senators who are, of course, beholden to the Zionist lobby. But he's a war criminal, and he engages in committing crimes against humanity, including genocide and racial discrimination and so on. So we really have to pay attention to these things, and we have to, again, we have to educate people, we have to spread the word, we have to show the evidence of this, which we have it. It's very obvious. As I said, even the UN issued declarations and guidelines and conventions, etc., that Israel is blatantly violating and ignoring. So we have to just keep on keeping on to push for, just like we did with South Africa, push for the truth to come out that this is an apartheid system, that this is a colonial system that is damaging to the environment and to the humans of this country, that this has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, it will lead to a regional war, which already started, and then a global war, which, of course, there will be no winners, only losers in a global war.
And do you see any hope for the popular resistance in Palestine and worldwide as a counter to what's happening right now, and a way forward to a democratic state in Palestine?
Well, yes, and I see hope always. And of course, we indigenous people don't have the luxury of despair. We cannot despair because it's an existential struggle for us. We must survive or we die, basically. Might as well commit suicide before they kill us. So the struggle for us is existential. And so we cannot afford not to have hope. And hope does not mean unrealistic expectations about the future. The slaves who endured slavery for hundreds of years, some of them never saw the end of slavery, and yet resistance among the slaves, the field slaves at least. You know, the house slaves accepted their faith, so to speak, and worked with the masters, but the field slaves resisted. And the resistance is not based on some, you know, delusional dream about freedom. It is our right to have freedom, so we engage in resistance to have freedom. And that's existential for us, as it was for any oppressed people around the world. We're not unique in this regard. So hence, you know, it does not necessarily mean 100%, I'm sure, we will all be free and have kumbaya, happiness, whatever. No, I mean, colonial situations are common around the world, and you can look at the outcome of those. Most of them are not pretty outcomes. And even when you have ending colonialism, you still have struggles within the country. Some countries are better than other countries. Mexico, for example, the descendants of the colonizers, the Spaniards, have intermarried with the descendants of the Aztecs. And Mexico City, you can't tell who is who anymore. That's certainly better than Brazil, which still has colonizing mentality and has people like Bolsonaro who wants to destroy the Amazon forest and kill the indigenous people and have cow farms in their place. So there's differences from country to country, from region to region, but the struggle must continue globally. Now, I am a bit more optimistic than, let's say, I would have been had I been colonized, like in, I don't know, Namibia by the Germans, or in the Congo by the Belgian colonization. The reason for that is we are in an era in the 21st century where colonization is frowned upon by the vast majority of people. That's number one. Number two, we have the internet and we have connectivity. And this genocide, for example, is being broadcast live around the world. So nobody can claim they don't know. Many people in Europe didn't know about the Belgian genocide of the Congo people or the German genocide in Namibia or the French genocide in Algeria. But now it's very difficult to hide these things. And the third thing that makes me even more optimistic about the outcome is because if we don't win and have freedom and human rights, then we are going into a third world war, and nobody will be a winner in that third world war. We will all be losers. And as you know, Israel has already started the regional war attacking Yemen and Syria and Lebanon and Iraq and other places, in addition to Palestine, of course. And regional wars have a tendency to become global wars. So we will see, but it doesn't mean I'm 100% sure that we will have freedom and that we won't go into a global war. In fact, I would give more weight to the possibility of going into a global war and we all end up dead, you know. But that doesn't mean we stop struggling. We have to keep struggling. We have to keep fighting for human rights, because ultimately we must say to ourselves, we have done everything we can, and the rest is not up to us.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Professor Kamsia, for joining us for this Nakba Day special on Radio Free Palestine. Again, Professor Mazen Kamsia at Bethlehem University.
Last night I had a dream in the land of olive trees, from the river to the sea. People tasted freedom. Soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights, as our voices start to rise. We're ending and up.